Today is Wednesday, September 5th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a contentious start to hearings on the president's Supreme Court nominee.
And that's going to be a major shift in Supreme Court's approach and the kinds of precedents that come out of it.
A new book that's being called the most damning portrait yet of the Trump White House.
There's a lot of name-calling in the book. The White House Chief of Staff, John Kelly, is described as calling the president unhinged and that he's an idiot.
In Syria, warnings of the impending battle for Idlib could be a bloodbath for civilians. Also ahead, how robots are helping educate girls in Cameroon. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court confirmation hearing of Brett Kavanaugh got off to a rocky start on Tuesday, with demonstrators shouting in opposition to his appointment and minority Democrats losing a bid to delay the proceedings until thousands of pages of documents related to Kavanaugh's past work at the White House are made public. Democratic lawmakers like Senator Kamala Harris of California complained that White House officials are withholding the documents from the early 2000s when Kavanaugh served as a staff secretary to former Republican President George W. Bush. They insist the documents will help them with their questioning.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to be recognized to ask a question before we proceed. The committee received just last night, less than 15 hours ago, 42,000 pages of documents that we have not had an opportunity to review or read or analyze.
You're out of order. I'll proceed.
New Jersey Democrat Cory Booker also pleaded with Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Chuck Grassley for a vote on the delay to give them time to review the documents.
So, sir, based upon your own principles, your own values, I call for at least to have a debate or a vote on these issues and not for us to rush through this process.
But Grassley rejected Booker's call, along with other Democratic senators, for any vote on whether to postpone the hearings until more documents are disclosed.
Senator Booker, I think that I respect very much a lot of things you do. But you spoke about my decency and my decency and integrity, and I think you are taking advantage of my decency and integrity.
Well, joining us now for analysis of all of this is Ben Foyer, an attorney with the California Appellate Law Group. So this was a very contentious hearing. How unprecedented was it with all the interruptions and protests?
Well, we're in pretty unprecedented times in a lot of ways. I think what's probably more unprecedented about this confirmation hearing, and probably much more substantively important, is the fact that this is only the second time in the modern era that a Supreme Court justice will not need a filibuster-proof majority in order to be confirmed. Neil Gorsuch was President Trump's previous nominee and appointment to the court. During his nomination, the Republicans in Congress removed the filibuster. Republicans in the Senate specifically removed the filibuster requirement for Supreme Court justice, which allows a Supreme Court justice to be confirmed with only a bare majority of the Senate, 51 votes. Now, through all of modern history, since the 1920s, Supreme Court justices have required 60 votes in order to be put up for a vote and become Supreme Court justices, at least the nominees. So that's what makes this probably much more different and unusual than past nomination proceedings, than even the shouting and some of the other things that have been going on.
I just don't recall a Supreme Court nominee confirmation hearing that was so contentious and shouting and protesters. What do you think about the documents that Democrats are so upset about that have not been released that would give them more information about Brett Kavanaugh to possibly ask questions about some of his decisions?
I mean, I think that all of the points that you made are signs of how unusual this is and the times we are in are. Certainly the shouting is pretty unusual for a Supreme Court confirmation hearing, but you have to remember this is an incredibly important and critical appointment. This is going to be the first time since the Great Depression that the conservative legal movement has had really an iron kind of fist of control on the Supreme Court. There will be five justices are true conservative, unbending conservative. And that's going to be a major shift in the Supreme Court's approach and the kinds of precedents that come out of the court.
Right.
Much less likely to see the kind of compromise and middle road that a court that needed to find balance would try to seek out. Brett Kavanaugh is definitely, unquestionably going to be confirmed to the United States Supreme Court. So the issue with the papers that have not been turned over, that are being vetted by various lawyers, it's certainly important. You know, I think that a potential life appointment to an extremely powerful position in the United States be fully vetted, but a lot of it is really pantomime. No matter what those papers say, Democrats are not going to be able to stop the confirmation of Judge Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. There is too much at stake.
Do you believe that Democrats' arguments that this could dramatically change the course of U.S. policy regarding things like gun control, gun rights, abortion, immigration?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know what dramatic change would be. Justice Gorsuch, for example, was confirmed also without a filibuster, so with just a bare majority, but he was replacing Justice Scalia, a very conservative justice, and then Justice Gorsuch is a very conservative justice with a similar constitutional approach. So in some ways, it didn't really alter balance on the court. Judge Kavanaugh is being appointed to replace Justice Kennedy. Now, on some issues, in fact, on many issues, Justice Kennedy was a very conservative justice. There were some notable issues in which he was in the liberal camp, obviously same-sex rights and same-sex marriage rights. There were numerous other issues in which he had a more liberal view, cases involving the death penalty, for example. Justice Kennedy was very skeptical and sometimes agreed with the liberal members of the court on death penalty issues, same-sex rights issues. Also, very much on abortion. Justice Kennedy, in many cases, joined with the liberals on abortion. So those are issues that I think the Democrats are probably correct to say Justice Kavanaugh may have a much more conservative viewpoint on than Justice Kennedy did.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. That's Ben Foyer, attorney with the California Appellate Law Group. President Donald Trump is asserting that quotes and stories in a new book about his presidency were made up frauds, a con on the public. Excerpts from the new book about the Trump presidency, authored by the journalist credited with helping to drive President Richard Nixon from power, describes the current administration as suffering a, quote, nervous breakdown during its first 19 months. Woodward also released a taped conversation he had with the president ahead of the book's release, saying he had made multiple attempts to interview him before finishing the book.
I spent a lot of time on this, talked to lots of people. And as you know and are living, we're at a pivot point in history.
Right.
And I would have liked to have done that, and I maximized my effort.
Right.
And somehow it didn't get to you. Or
it's really too bad because nobody told me about it, and I would have loved to have spoken to you. You know I'm very open to you. I think you've always been fair, but we'll see what happens.
Well, we get more details now from VOA Chief White House Correspondent Steve Herman. Steve, the headline on the VOA website says this is possibly the most damning account yet of the Trump White House.
Well, it's 448 pages long, and a few news organizations got advanced copies of this book, which is coming out in about a week. And it is written by Bob Woodward, who is a very famous journalist in the United States because he was of the Woodward and Bernstein team at the Washington Post in the early 1970s that broke the Watergate scandal story that led to President Richard Nixon's eventual resignation.
Woodward is seen as a pretty credible journalist. He seems to have stated that he has the facts to back this up, that he has, you know, the times and the days and the people that he was speaking with.
Right. Woodward is regarded as one of the best book writers in Washington, and he always backs his books up with a tremendous amount of footnotes and documentation. And in this particular case, although the president's initial reaction and others in the administration that this is a work of fiction, it's going to be very difficult to credibly reject what Woodward is writing in this book and the numerous damaging allegations that are made, because they are obviously coming from people who were in the White House firsthand.
What sorts of things is he talking about that seems so disturbing?
Well, we have a case in the White House where we're moving papers that the president was supposed to sign from the commander-in-chief's desk because they were worried that a signature could have serious implications for national security. There's a lot of name-calling in the book. The White House Chief of Staff John Kelly is described as calling the president unhinged and that he's an idiot. It's pointless to try to convince him of anything. He's gone off the rails. Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis says that the president comprehends material at the level of a fifth or sixth grader and wanted to order the assassination of Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria. We have another situation described in the book where at the time the president's lead attorney, personal attorney John Dowd, called the president a liar, was trying to talk him out of testifying to the special counsel Robert Mueller, who's looking into the ties between Trump's election campaign and Russia, warning the president that if he did give testimony, he'd end up wearing an orange jumpsuit, in other words, a prison uniform. I think we should say that from the president on down, including the defense secretary, the chief of staff, the White House press secretary, that they're all denying what's being written in this book, describing it essentially as a work of fiction. But it's going to be very hard for that to stick when this is coming from someone as reputable as Bob Woodward.
He's such a reputable journalist, but then you've got, you know, Chief of Staff John Kelly and Secretary of Defense John Kelly, who are also known to be very credible people.
Yes, definitely very credible people. It's unknown whether either of them talked to Woodward, but it's obvious that certain people who have since left the White House are likely sources for a lot of the material in the book. I would say that the departed White House staff secretary, Rob Porter, pops up a lot in this book. That would be an indication that perhaps he was one of the sources. Also, the president's former top economic advisor, Gary Cohen, appears to be another source for this material. The question would be whether any of those high-ranking officials that are still in the White House were direct sources for Woodward.
We've seen a lot of books coming out in the past year, painting this president in a negative light on many occasions. Would this be any different as far as having any impact?
Oh, I think, yes, it is much different and will have much more impact because the credibility of the other authors or their motivation for writing the books could be questioned. So, yes, this will cause an earthquake. How damaging it will be remains to be seen. I think for a lot of the president's supporters, they'll just regard this as more fake news, a bunch of lies, because that's what the president will say about it. And it may not rock his base as much as some of the president's detractors would like it to.
VOA Chief White House Correspondent Steve Herman. The book titled Fear is available on September 11th. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Hey, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the Voice of America.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. President Trump will chair a UN Security Council meeting on Iran. Fighting continues in parts of the Libyan capital as the UN urges calm. Former Arizona Senator John Kyle has been tapped to replace the late John McCain. And USA Gymnastics says its CEO is out in the latest post-scandal shakeup. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The U.S. said Tuesday it would respond swiftly and appropriately with Russian and Iranian support, uses chemical weapons in an imminent attack on Idlib province, the last rebel stronghold in Syria. The White House said in a statement the U.S. is closely monitoring the fate of Idlib, where it said millions of innocent civilians are under threat of imminent attack by the regime of President Bashar al-Assad. UN Special Envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, is warning that a fight for Idlib would be a bloodbath.
Inside Idlib area, there are 2.9 million people. I repeat it because it's an enormous figure. Now, out of them, 1 million children. Okay? These are not terrorists, 1 million children. Not even the 2.9 million people.
The Mistura said the assault could begin next week. David Lesh, a history professor at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas, tells VOA's Victor Beatty he believes there is little the U.S. is prepared to do to stop the impending assault.
Frankly speaking, I don't think there's anything the United States can do about it. I think Russia and the Syrian government and their allies are dead set on taking over Idlib, either in a phased way or an all-out massive invasion. And in President Trump's tweet where he said the United States is against reckless invasion, it's not necessarily against the invasion, but against reckless invasion, it seems to be a hint toward civilian casualties, particularly the use of chemical weapons. And in fact, before this tweet, that had been the only admonition from the United States to Russia and the Syrian government was do not use chemical weapons. So they're ratcheting up the pressure a little bit, but I don't think there's anything the United States can do at this point to stop what I see as inevitable.
Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif made a surprise trip to Damascus. At the start of a visit, he said the terrorists must be purged from Syria's Idlib and the entire northwest province returned to government control.
Well, not only the Iranians, but the Russian foreign minister and other Russian officials have said the exact same thing and using a word that they've used traditionally in the course of the civil war to describe the opposition of any type. Of course, the Syrian government has used that language as well. And in the last week or so, in the ramping up of the psychological and propaganda atmosphere before the offensive, you know, was to convince the international community that they are, in fact, rooting out terrorists. And, of course, Idlib has become the repository for what remains of the jihadist portion of the Syrian opposition, particularly what used to be the element aligned with al-Qaeda. So, you know, there is some truth to that, to the point where even Turkey, which has traditionally supported the anti-Assad opposition, has been attempting to separate the non-jihadists from the jihadist opposition. And, of course, has been consulting with Iran and Russia along those lines. Although I don't think certainly an easy separation can occur in Idlib because of the mixture of populations, because it has been not only a repository for jihadists, but opposition of all kinds who have been evacuated from a number of different fronts across Syria.
UN Security Council is scheduled to take up the matter of Idlib on Friday. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is due to visit Pakistan Wednesday for the first high-level official meetings with leaders of the newly elected government in Islamabad, as bilateral relations have deteriorated to the lowest ebb in the past year. VOA's Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad spoke with VOA's Ira Melman about the expectations of both sides as the meeting approaches.
Well, I think before his arrival, the U.S. officials have already made it very clear that this visit is primarily to remind Pakistan that there is still job to be done in terms of clearing militants of Pakistani soil that the U.S. believes are behind attacks inside Afghanistan. You know, that war in Afghanistan is already has already entered in the 17th year, and it's becoming more and more deadly and putting a lot of pressure on the U.S.-led coalition, which has been trying to basically help Afghan forces maintain control over the territory under the Afghan government. But what we have seen over the last few weeks is that the Taliban is on the offensive and has captured more territory and has killed so many Afghan soldiers that it has now put a lot of pressure on Washington how to go about a peaceful settlement for this conflict. And that is where the role of Pakistan comes, because there's still strong perception that Pakistan has a lot of influence with the Taliban, and that those Taliban leaders who are using Pakistani soil for plotting attacks inside Afghanistan, that Islamabad can influence them and push them to go for negotiations with the Afghan government. I mean, that's what Pompeo is going to bring to the table when he sits down with Pakistan's Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi and Prime Minister Imran Khan, who have just taken control of the newly elected government hardly 2 weeks ago.
And that is the next question, as to what is the difference that Pompeo and Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Joseph Dunford faces with a new administration atop the Pakistan government.
Imran Khan has been campaigning that Pakistan should not rely on any foreign assistance that it has been receiving over the past 17 years from the U.S. to fight war, because Imran Khan believes that this is what has weakened Pakistan's position internally and externally. And here is a leader now who has solely, who's become the prime minister of this country based on these slogans that no cooperation with the U.S. in return for money. It has to be a relationship mutually benefited to both the countries. So these are the things which Imran Khan's government will be placing before Pompeo's delegation. And so that is why there are very low expectations, are really low, whether there will be any reasonable outcome to the demands that Pakistan has to fight these militants who are allegedly using the Pakistani soil, because that is the United States' primary concern. But here is a leader who has done something different. And if he goes ahead and does exactly the same thing that the previous Pakistani rulers have been doing, I think it will be a major political setback for this new government. And there will be a lot of criticism at home. So this is the first time that a dialogue is going to take place between the two countries where neither side is willing or will be willing to back down on its stated position.
All right. The Pentagon announced last week it had decided to scrap $300 million in military aid to Pakistan, citing the country's lack of cooperation with President Trump's South Asia strategy. You're listening to International Edition on VOA. Well, the technology sector provides many jobs for today's innovators. But one scientist and a teacher in Cameroon says there's no reason why women should not be part of that technological growth, making it her goal to prepare more young girls to enter the workforce. Arash Arabasadi has more.
The kids controlling these robots are studying to become the innovators of the future. At a time when 95% of the kids around the world who do not attend school are girls, these young women hope to change that.
Other people inspired me with their stories, with what they do, with what they did, and I want to empower myself as well, and also I aspire to inspire other girls to take part in such activities.
Here at the Next Gen Center in Cameroon, about 20 young students are learning how to write code and build robots, skills that may help them fill the jobs of tomorrow while addressing gender inequality and the lack of opportunities for women today.
If there's any young girl that has exceptional ability and is extraordinary, it's all about helping them get to where they want to go to. Actually, it starts with them. It's a dream. So nurturing someone's dream and then taking the person to the height of their ability.
The most recent data from the United Nations shows that women and girls account for 60% of Cameroon's illiterate population. By focusing on girls, NextGen is hoping to move more women away from poverty.
We do not want to find situations where people are not achieving their potential because they did not have the opportunity. So we are leveling the ground.
Which paves the way for next-gen students like Lynn, who wants to someday build a robot that can translate conversations between doctors and patients who live in remote areas.
If they can speak in their own language and the robot translates it to the doctor, which will be able to interpret what they're suffering from and find a cure for them.
NextGen's founder has initiated a similar program to train 800 students. That's a big win for everyone, not just young women. The latest UN research shows that if all girls in the world received a secondary education, child deaths would be cut in half, saving 3 million lives across the globe. Arash Erbasadi, VOA News.
Well, athletic shoemaker Nike has touched off a furor by wading into American-style professional football's national anthem debate with an ad featuring former San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick. He's been at the center of a debate over kneeling in protest of racial discrimination during the national anthem. Over 30,000 people have been tweeting with the hashtag boycott or Nike boycott on Tuesday, making it among the top trending topics on Twitter. The AP's Ed Donahoe reports.
Stock in Nike dropped after the release of the new Just Do It ads. The Kaepernick ad reads, "Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything." New Yorker Lou Orlando says Nike did this so Kaepernick won't sue the NFL.
He started all this garbage with all this kneeling down, and look what he did. You know, it created a whole bad effect for football.
Usually, most companies stay away from politics. For people like Jane Cunniff, politics brought her closer to Nike.
I have always worn New Balance because I have wide feet, and now I would like to wear Nike because I would be proud to wear Nike.
I'm Ed Donahue.
That does it for today's international edition, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. And we thank you for joining us. Also, thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, recently announced additional assistance to support achieving the goals outlined in the Bilateral Development Objectives Assistance Agreement between the U.S. and Nigerian governments, signed in 2015. $25 million will strengthen good governance by supporting state governments' efforts to bolster Nigeria's open government partnership commitments to improve transparency and fight corruption. An additional $1.5 million will support a healthier, more educated population in targeted states through the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, also known as PEPFAR, for a total of $26.5 million in additional assistance. The additional new funding brings the total U.S. government assistance provided under the five-year Development Objectives Agreement to $1.1 billion. USAID is also working with federal and state health ministries to build stronger health systems with the aim of guaranteeing equitable access to quality health care services nationwide. USAID collaborated with Nigeria's Ministries of Budget and National Planning, Health, Agriculture, Power, and Education, as well as state-level government counterparts, to structure the Bilateral Assistance Agreement, which runs through 2020. The United States believes that as the most populous country in Africa with the largest economy on the continent, Nigeria holds tremendous influence over the future of Africa, Acting Mission Director Aaron Holleran said. USAID is committed to partnering with the government and the people of Nigeria to address its development challenges.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.